just summarize 40 pages in a sentence, it would be, you need to know as much about your partner's activity as you do about your own in-house activity on your own product. The good news is that actually I think there's a bunch of technology coming that's going to help with that.
Welcome to the Operate Podcast, where we give you a behind-the-scenes look at company building from the perspective of the builders themselves. This is how we operate.
Welcome to the Operate Podcast. I'm Carrie Ransom. Today's episode is sponsored by BankTech Ventures, the first strategic investment fund designed by the community banking industry for community bank innovation and investment. BankTech identifies leading products and technologies for community banks and works with the founders and management teams to maximize their impact for community banks and their businesses. If you're a bank looking to innovate and invest in the future, or a founder who wants to work with community banks, reach out to BankTech Ventures at banktechventures.com. My guest today is Adam Shapiro, who is partner and co-founder at Claros Group. They're an advisory and investment firm focused at the intersection of finance, innovation, and regulation. He's also an advisor to Core VC, which is a leading fintech investment firm, and does a lot of venture investing in some really interesting early stage companies. He's spent his entire career in the financial services industry and really has worked across banks. He's been inside the regulatory environment in the UK at the FSA, and even at what I would characterize as an early fintech-like company, Promontory Group. He hails from England, which you'll pick up for sure in his accent, but he's been in the US for quite a while. Adam, it's great to finally have you on here after we have talked about it for a while. Thanks for joining me today.
It's great to be here. Looking forward to it.
Awesome. Well, let's jump right in. It has been a fascinating year at that intersection of finance, innovation, and regulation. And so you've been in the middle of it. Let's start with the topic of banking as a service, or as those of us inside this world call it, BaaS. We've really seen a lot of regulatory activity there that we haven't seen as much of, if ever. If I'm a bank and I'm working with fintechs and I'm a banking as a service bank right now, or I'm thinking about getting into it, where do you direct them? What should I be thinking about if I'm in that world right now from your perspective?
It's a great question. Obviously, the regulatory scrutiny is going up. And the first question I think to answer is, why is that? And I think there are a couple of questions, a couple of things that are going on there. One of which is simply, I think if you were to get a senior regulator and were having a candid off-the-record conversation over a beer, you'd probably get an acknowledgement that the regulators hadn't invested enough historically in building expertise in this space. It's a very particular type of business, and examining it well requires strong expertise. And all the regulators responding to a number of incidents that I suspect you, and I suspect a lot of people here will be able to think of some of them offhand, really, I think, focused on building that expertise. And that means that the standard of examination is going to go up, and you're much more likely to be compared against good practice that they're seeing in other partner banks than have an examiner that's come from sort of examining three traditional community banks in a row. And that makes a big difference. I also think, though, that it's important for the industry to look itself in the eye and sort of acknowledge that there have been some weaknesses and flaws in how risk management and compliance oversight have been conducted in this industry. And some of those, I think, are things that can be solved with technology. Sort of in total, sort of too much of the oversight is based by sort of reading words on a piece of paper or pixels on a screen in terms of policies and programs, and too little has been based in actual outcomes that the programs are achieving and evaluating whether compliance and risk management outcomes are being achieved. And you see that very clearly, particularly, I think, in the enforcement action the FDIC gave Cross River last year, which if you wanted to summarize 40 pages in a sentence, it would be something like, you need to know as much about your partner's activity as you do about your own in-house activity on your own products. And when you put it like that, it's hard to argue with. And the good news is that actually I think there's a bunch of technology coming that's going to help with that.
Well, great place to jump off for sure. And I think to your point, I think it's been a great reminder to those banks who are doing it that it shouldn't be. And I don't think most of them looked at it as a shortcut. It's a line of business like any other line of business that you would have at your bank. And you need, certainly from a compliance and regulatory standpoint, take it equally, if not more seriously, because of how much of some of those operational duties are being offered or outsourced to the partner.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. And not just it's a line of business, but it's a line of business that you need to invest in.
That's right.
No one is going to make themselves rich by having one or two partners. It sort of feels like, especially on the payments and deposits side, it's a scale business. You build infrastructure to oversee it, and then you need a volume of clients to recoup the cost of that investment in infrastructure. It's kind of almost no mileage in having something between 1 and 15 clients. You can argue about what the top number is, unless you're sort of aiming for greater than 15 or zero. Hopefully the former. I mean, I do think, as an aside, that however much of a bad rap this sector gets, it is the main driver of consumer and small business facing innovation in the US, especially in an environment where often the alternative is to go and get a lot of state licenses and have sort of 53 different regulators.
That's right. That's right. So many good points in there, Adam. And you know, it's funny, as you know, I spent the last decade prior to really focusing on the investment side in that operating side as a fintech and partnered with banks. And so several of our banks will ask me just for a perspective on it. And I think the two things I often say, one is sort of your point on scale, is don't do this if you're only thinking about one or two partners. You need to take a portfolio approach, and kind of like investing in early stage companies, because most of these are early stage partnerships, recognize that some of them probably aren't going to scale and work. And that's okay from a business standpoint if you have a big enough portfolio. The other side, though, is don't mix the business risk with these partners with the compliance risk, and make sure that you have very clear regulatory and compliance standards for each one, irrespective of their business performance, because you don't want their failure as a business to have blowback to you from a compliance standpoint. And I think some of them have been a little bit lax about that. And so curious how you think about those. But those have kind of been the two points I've tried to make, at least in advising if I were in their shoes.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. One way that I think people don't often account for this is in terms of how they price and not really pricing in the cost of doing the oversight well.
And, good point.
It's certainly true that a bunch of programs that you bring on are going to either sort of totally die or will sort of sputter along at low levels. And so you have to sort of assume that if you sort of get a couple of years of close to the monthly minimums that you're charging, one rule of thumb I often give people is you want to be able to look at the cost of the oversight you're going to have to do and try and sort of break even on those sorts of clients so that you're actually making real profit on the ones that do get market traction.
Absolutely. Totally agree. Well, you also work beyond banks, you work with a lot of fintechs. So if you're talking to a fintech right now, the environment, the number of banks who want to bring on new partners has definitely shrunk a little bit in the near term and probably slowed as well. So how are you sort of advising them in this environment?
And I think shrunk a bit is about right. It's sort of like we've seen some enforcement actions that have prohibitions on new business. And as you know, but possibly some people listening along might not, there are also non-public enforcement actions which we can't see. And there are some of those out in the market that are also restricting new business. So we're only seeing part of it in terms of what's publicly. But it's also true that there are new entrants coming in that see an opportunity to build it right first time. We've actually worked with three different banks over the last year at Claros that see this as a good time to get into the market, that they can build risk management programs the right way, that they can think smartly and learn from the experience of incumbents about what technology works and what doesn't, and think about sort of positioning themselves from a business perspective as well. Are you fundamentally going to be looking to serve embedded finance clients that are going to want more compliance and risk management as a service, but because you're doing more, easier to oversee, but you have to build more? Or do you want to be servicing fintech clients and just be really good at the oversight? And so it's actually a pretty good time to be starting with a fresh sheet of paper and some of the incumbents dealing with some issues. And I think that will continue to be true for a while. But to get back to your original question, yes, it is a challenging time. We're actually working with a couple of larger fintechs that are heavily reliant on partner banks to sort of help understand, well, should you be diversifying the banks you're working with? Maybe are you actually on a primary bank that was the one that you happened to come to first, but maybe you've actually outgrown their capabilities and you actually should maybe think about making them your secondary bank and transitioning a bunch of business? And also about how do you actually sort of proof yourself against sort of the regulatory environment and what your partners are doing? And one thing that we talk about a lot with our clients there is if the regulators have an issue with the bank, it's likely they've also got an issue with some of the underlying programs that are being run through the bank. And you don't want to be one of the programs they've got a problem with. And in fact, you've got quite a lot of control about that. If you actually understand what your bank needs to be evidencing to its regulators, even if they're not asking you for it, you can give it to them proactively. It will up in the files. And effectively, you may have trouble launching sort of like new activity with the bank, but short of the regulators feeling the need to tell a bank to get out of the business entirely, which is rare, you're going to be all right if you can show that sort of you're doing all of the right things, and that evidence will shine through indirectly to the examiners.
That's great point. And I think just like you were saying, the expectation for the bank that they know everything that's going on inside the fintech, I generally would agree that the fintech should think like the bank and do as much of that proactive to help their partner be successful as possible. So I think that's fantastic advice. The other thing that occurs to me, when I first got into this, it felt like a huge barrier to entry to even do this, to be a fintech that was going to work with a bank. We needed, in our case, a big balance sheet, and we needed sufficient capital to even put the infrastructure on our side in place for compliance and legal and other areas. And it felt like over the last few years that a number of these fintech startups were starting with too little, to be honest. Do you think that barrier to entry, that the bar should be a little bit higher and kind of back to where it was maybe 5+ years ago?
Well, I think effectively, I like the barrier to entry being relatively low for the point of view of having a vibrant innovative ecosystem, because let's face it, no one is very happy with the status quo, which is one of the reasons people like you and me spend so much time in fintech. But so to me, the trick is, how can you actually help people start with the higher bar from earlier? And I see some things that are really promising there. So sort of 5 years ago, almost no partner bank was able, working off a sort of pooled account model, as is common in prepaid world and payments programs, was able to sort of disaggregate customer activity to do transaction monitoring at the customer level. And now that is increasingly becoming table stakes. And that means that there is less pressure on early stage startups to work out what they need to do in relation to transaction monitoring. They're still, they can't ignore the transactions. There's broad risk. They've got sort of, there's an expectation they'll look, but the pressure is lower. And I think finding ways to do that and finding ways to alert more, I'm very interested in sort of technologies that can sort of give you 100% automated assurance that sort of things are there. And so I think everyone would breathe easier, the startups, the partner banks, the regulators, if there was sort of a widget embedded sort of in the fintech programs software that checked that all the disclosures had been given, all the necessary customer consents had been received, periodic statements were being delivered as they're supposed to be. And so I think really the trick is let's not sort of try and lower the bar, but let's use technology to make sure that the bar can be at a level where we're confident we're sort of building compliant products that are safe for consumers and small businesses to use.
That totally makes sense. I think that's great clarifying. Appreciate that. Well, one of the ways that a lot of these startups did try to get off the ground faster and cheaper were these, what I call BaaS middleware providers. And there were a number of those that emerged over the last several years. I'm curious your thoughts on those from both the opportunity and the risk side.
So I think that there is a lot that is interesting about what these middleware providers have done. It's kind of, it's certainly, most of them have better technology for fintech partners to connect with than a sort of a bank that, especially a bank that's sort of coming into the game new. What's really, I think, been sort of an important distinction is, well, how do they manage the relationship between the underlying program and the bank? And I think you can look at sort of where people are, and that there's a spectrum from a sort of like, we want to be in the middle of everything approach, where sometimes, you know, the partner will, the program will contract with the middleware provider, and then the middleware provider will contract with the bank, and the middleware provider will want to intermediate all of the controls. And I think we've seen some flaws in that model. And so the models I like are the ones where effectively sort of the middleware provider is providing enabling technology and in some cases operations, but there is not just sort of direct contractual privity, but also a robust and meaningful dialogue directly between the bank and the program. And so as enablers, I think there's a lot to be done. One thing that I've sort of found, one of the banks that we helped stand up a program has done a deal with one of the middleware providers, and I thought it had a very interesting structure. The sort of, like, as we were looking at it, we wanted to be able to have them as a source of clients, but we also went through the process of agreeing with the middleware provider there would be that sort of multilateral contract that sort of, and not to do that, but also the contract allows for the bank to use the underlying technology, obviously for a fee, for clients that it sources itself. So it's sort of the best of both worlds. It gives the bank the ability to build directly. It gives appropriate incentives to the middleware provider to support that, and it adds another bank to the stable of the customers the middleware provider is sourcing directly. And I think those sorts of relationships, I think, have a lot of value potentially.
Yeah, that makes sense and great perspective. Well, to wrap up this segment of our conversation, I think the last thing I'd love is, let's play this out 5-10 years from now. I think you and I both would agree that banking as a service, fintechs partnering with banks is not going away, and it's just going to keep iterating, evolving. So I'm just curious your perspective Where do you think this sits 5-10 years from now?
I totally agree it's not going away, and also strongly believe it would be a shame that it did.
Sure.
But what I do think it will happen is that it will grow in different ways. And it feels like we're probably in sort of, I draw a distinction between the fintech partner banking and embedded finance partner banking, as I mentioned earlier. And it feels like we're in about the top of the second inning in sort of playing out the embedded finance story.
Very early.
I do think in 5-10 years time, an increasing amount of the fintech business is still going to be there, but an increasing amount of embedded finance business will be there. And I suspect actually some partner banks may do both. Some may choose to specialize in one type of client. And if you're a believer, as I am, in the embedded finance market, it's what you need to be thinking strategically now about, well, what are those clients going to want? And there's some good news there. They want to do less themselves. They're probably a little bit less price sensitive than the fintech, because often sort of they're adding on financial services to an existing product, sometimes to monetize it, but actually not always. Sometimes that's about improving the ecosystem. So there's good money to be made. You can have a higher share of the stack and come up with win-wins, but you've got to build more capabilities to support it. Over on the fintech side, I've got a client at the moment that has great data to do invoice advance lending. They would love a bank partner that has operational capability that could be applied to that. And I think there are some great niches like that where there are going to be really profitable businesses built, where sort of the banks are very much in control of their own destiny on a lot of the control things. But that does take more building than simply launching a fintech BaaS business.
Yeah, well, great perspective. I mean, that, and what a great way to jump into this conversation. Thanks for indulging me and just jumping right in.
It's a fantastic conversation. And I will say, I absolutely sort of love the idea of, there are a number of funds that working to sort of in a way that will helps banks and sort of good technology come together. And you really see the sort of in some of the investments in the ecosystem that it's sort of producing companies that sort of are really solving real world problems, because it's got the perspective. I'm excited at the sort of contribution of what you and people that are working in similar ways are doing.
Well, appreciate that. Well, let's talk a little bit about your firm. So as I mentioned, you know, you're one of the co-founders and a partner at Claros. I'm curious though, just talk inception, what led you all to start it?
Well, I mean, I think a number of things. Firstly, we're a bunch of geeks at the intersection of financial services, technology, and regulation. But as we looked around, one of the things that we saw was that it was very hard to find advice that sort of helped people sort of holistically with developing the right business and control strategies to achieve their objectives. That there can be sort of tensions in that, and it requires creative thinking. And sometimes you have one set of people advising on the business strategy, another set on the sort of regulation compliance and controls. And it's kind of, if you don't look at the whole picture, it's hard to bring together. So we set out to create a firm that would have deep expertise sort of in both, that could help people sort of relate their regulatory strategy to their business strategy and optimize across the two. So that was one of the frames. The other frame is that I think we find a lot of joy in building our own team of people that we enjoy seeing when they appear in rectangular boxes in front of us, and enjoy seeing even more when we can get together in real life. And then if you build a firm smartly, and like a lot of our clients who kind of live in developing everything in SaaS and the cloud, and you don't sort of overcommit to office space, sort of all the things that sort of cause professional services firms to have trade-offs, then you can focus on really working with interesting people that are doing interesting things and offering sort of high quality advice at a competitive price point. And if you're going to be doing advisory work, sort of the larger the firm gets, the harder it is to sort of manage for that trade-off.
Yeah, great point. Well, I'm curious, it's been over 4 years now. As you look back, what surprised you about where you've ended up putting a lot of your time and attention? Has it been in mostly the areas you anticipated, or has it been somewhat different?
Yeah, it really has. And a lot of the focus has shifted, and it's shifted with both sort of like market and regulatory trends. And we would have predicted that's the case. These things always go in cycles. But when we started, there was a clear window of opportunity for later stage fintechs to get banking licenses if they put together well thought through applications. And we did a lot of work that was sort of around, firstly, helping people assess whether they should get a bank charter, where we figured there was a market niche for a firm that sort of didn't get sort of dollar signs in their eyes about sort of how much money they could make on a project, and would tell most people that came to us with that question, no, it actually doesn't make sense for you, and having delved into it, and here's why. And secondly, then helping people navigate the process. And a variety of reasons sort of effectively, it's become harder and harder for all applicants, but particularly non-traditional applicants, to do that. And as that has happened, we've found ourselves spending more time, whether working for fintechs or the partner banks, actually working on partner bank issues, because that's clearly the main game in town to make things happen. I'd also note, as someone that does a lot of work in payments, that we've seen an uptick that I think you can also partly attribute to a combination of the bank charter activity and the partner bank activity, and people seeking state licenses, whether that's money transfer mission licenses or lending licenses. And we're also seeing an increasing amount of work about sort of, well, should we be going after non-bank licensing, and help us figure that out and work out what we need to do.
Interesting. Well, a lot of different spaces for sure, and all compelling. And to your point, these things sort of seem to ebb and flow. Do you envision a day where you think we're going to see a lot of new bank charters or de novo financial institutions emerge here?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing to say is that to some extent, having started my sort of career in the UK, I feel I'm in sort of bizarro land. I started my career at a time there had been almost no new banks in the UK for decades, and there were 100 new banks a year being chartered in the US. And now the UK is very much open and sort of encouraging new banks, and it's become a lot harder in the US. I do think that will turn. I don't think it's going to go back to hundreds a year either. And I mean, I do think that it would be helpful to have a more of a discussion about what our risk tolerance for failure of small banks in ways that don't affect the deposit insurance fund is. And it's kind of, I think maybe we've had a tendency to overreact to that a little bit. And, you know, I feel very sympathetic for these inquiries. It's hard on the supervisors in question. Everything looks easy in hindsight. It would be helpful to say that actually, yes, there is some healthy rate of bank failure, and especially amongst smaller banks, and especially when this leads to closures that don't actually end up costing the deposit insurance fund money. But it feels like there needs to be some risk tolerance here, and the current regulators are de facto saying that they have pretty much no risk tolerance.
Yeah, I agree, which it's an interesting tension. And I mean, it is a super challenging place to build businesses. I mean, even as a fintech, it is hard. Now, you know, a lot of them had bad business model concepts. So that's different than just a difficult regulatory operating environment to build a business in. But do you think it should be easier? I mean, I guess you mentioned, you know, there should be some amount of acceptable loss, acceptable failure, but Do you think it should be easier for people to house or move or lend people money?
I mean, I think we probably had a little bit of a sort of late stage gold rush in the fintech sector where people got carried away. And I think one thing that we got lost in that is how hard it actually is to sort of compete against the incumbents. Everyone loves to hate on the big banks, but they actually have good, workable, reliable products. They have large customer bases in a place where it is sticky to get people to shift. On the lending side, they have a huge cost of funding advantage over them. And I think what we're actually edging towards is a world in which people are being much more explicit about sort of trying to find an area where they do have a clear competitive advantage, or is just for various reasons not being served by large incumbent institutions. So we're seeing more sort of technology infrastructure. A lot of the things that I'm most interested in are around sort of what we're seeing on the edges, where financial services is being integrated into other businesses that are solving problems. And so it's especially on the payments side, there are very distinct ways in which things like the sort of certain payments have to be made. If you're in the construction industry, it's sort of like you need to sort of have payments that are sort of conditioned on permits, that work is completed, removal of lien waivers, all of those things. And there is a business that can be built, especially by someone that has an existing customer base. We're also seeing some startups wearing my core hat that are looking to solve problems in the sort of gig economy 1099 world around sort of helping people account for payments and have tax solutions and then building financial services on top of that. And I think we're coming towards an era where people are going to have to define a lot more clearly sort of why they've got a comparative advantage or why they found a niche market that isn't going to be well served by things that are out there.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about these niches is they're sticky and you can expand into adjacent niches pretty easily if you build good product.
That's right. Well, you've seen this evolution in financial services from kind of every angle. You've seen it from the bank side and large and smaller institutions. You've seen it in early fintech. You've seen it in even the regulatory environment. And there is a tension there. And I think it's somewhat easy to say it's healthy that you have people that are innovating and trying new things, and you have rules of how this is supposed to work, and they're not always defined. And sometimes they end up having to get defined after the fact. I'm curious, as you think about that, you know, what about that do you feel like does work and maybe doesn't?
I think one thing that works is that sort of we have to understand that there are market failures that need to be solved here. This isn't just regulators making things up. The stability of the financial system is a public good. Apologies for going back to my 101 economics for the moment. There are big information asymmetries between consumers and small businesses and providers. And what's worse is when something's gone wrong, it's too late to do something about it. It's a sort of deep experience good in that sense. And so certainly the answer is not to sort of get rid of all of the regulation. I do think there are some things that sort of everyone can change about how they're doing things. And in the traditional world, I sometimes think that the regulators get used as an easy crutch within firms to get people to say, no, the regulators will never do it. And I'm a firm believer that no one has ever been told not to do something by the regulator when they've walked through the regulator's front door with a plan and said, let us explain to you what we're going to do. This is what we want to do. This is why we want to do it. This is how we're going to pilot and test and evaluate it. And this is how we're going to sort of thinking about the control environment that's needed. And we will keep you posted as we go. It's just rightly not in the DNA of a regulator just to say, blanket no. Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes firms assume that it actually is and effectively sort of use the regulators as a convenient scapegoat. From the point of view of the fintech world, one thing that I always spend time with a new client doing is just checking that the key people have a good understanding of what are the risk and compliance issues that matter in their business. There's sometimes a tendency for people to think that, well, if you've done AML, you've done compliance, for example. And what I find is that sort of the people that actually understand sort of like the public policy reasons why their business needs the level of regulation it gets and understand the history of all the things that have gone wrong that make regulators skeptical build better, safer product. And mm-hmm. so sometimes I think it's simply a question in the fintech world of taking the time to find the right people to talk to that will help you understand what this will look like to regulated partners and regulators.
Very helpful perspective. Well, let's do a little rapid fire. 2024, we're into a new year. What do you think the biggest news in banking is likely to be this year?
I think this is going to be the year we see a bunch of deals. There are still structural balance sheet issues that some banks need to solve as new capital rules and heightened expectations for larger banks come in. Some banks need to get bigger, some banks need to get smaller, sort of. So we'll see mergers, we'll see sales of specific businesses and portfolios, and we'll generally see a lot of right sizing to the new environment.
Okay. Well, that was great. How about in the regulatory environment? What do you think the biggest news coming out of the regulatory world will be here in the US this year?
I think it's largely going to be enforcement related. And part of that is not just necessarily a comment about upticks in enforcement, but it's also a comment about where we are in the political cycle. It's kind of like you want to get rules passed that can't be challenged and overturned in the new Congress. The window is passed if they're not at least published in draft at the moment. Mm-hmm. And once they're published in draft, you kind of know where the world's going. So I think the action in new things from regulators is much more likely to be focused on a combination of enforcement actions and understanding priorities that are coming from speeches than it is out of the policy world. I think there are a couple of things out there, particularly on the CFPB side with the open banking rules and the large provider rules for the payments and wallets market, where you might see a final rule that looks quite different in some ways based on feedback. And so those will be interesting to watch too.
Great perspective. Finally, let's talk about fintechs. Any major news you want to project you think will be noteworthy this year from the fintech world?
I think it's going to be a good year for the people that have planned to hunker down. Funding environment, I think, will remain tough, and particularly beyond A rounds. It's kind of, Carter's published some really interesting data last week that sort of suggested that B onwards have corrected way more than A and seed. And it's going to be a year where people are trying to sort of stretch runway, do more. And we're still seeing a very bumpy environment on the wholesale loan funding side for lending startups as well. But, you know, what I am optimistic about is the tough times actually make for robust companies that have to sort of work out where to put their dollars carefully and build very intentionally and not overhire. And so it's kind of, I think in retrospect, we may look back and say, well, the last year and the next year or two ends up producing a crop of really interesting companies that really had to define themselves and excel from the beginning.
Good perspective. I think you're right. I think most of us on the funding side feel like this past year, and I would say even this year and probably next, we're going to see some pretty interesting companies to get behind at much more favorable terms than we maybe saw a few years ago. Well, thank you for that, Adam. Final few minutes together. Let's talk a little bit about you. You know, as I mentioned, you know, you're a Brit, but have been here for quite a while. When you think about your superpower in this world, you've been in the financial service industry for a long time. What do you consider to be your primary superpower?
would it be cheating to have two that relate? It's totally. The first one is a sort of understanding the unfamiliar and being able to apply sort of knowledge and experience and precedent to it. And the second is in terms of being able to explain to different audiences in terms they can understand sort of what's unfamiliar to them. And so I spent a lot of time, as you'll recall, at one point in my life, sort of going back and forth between, if you like, the good end of the crypto 1.0 industry and the 197 state and federal agencies in the US that had some interest in it, and really helping the startups understand sort of like why there was legitimate public policy concerns here, and helping agencies understand why this was an exciting technology that deserved a chance. And we did need to aim off for the fact that the initial users of almost everything in payments have historically been the illegal and the marginally legal. And they work well in situations like that. I love it when people are building a product that we haven't seen before and we have to try and sort of figure out how to get that right. I love that in the partner bank ecosystem at the moment, where we're looking for a new model of how to sort of do risk management more efficiently and effectively.
Very cool. Well, as you're clearly someone that continues to evolve and learn yourself, any area that you're particularly investing in your own capabilities right now?
Yeah, I'm spending a lot of time trying to understand better what makes me happy. I've sort of come to the conclusion that my effectiveness just correlates incredibly closely with how happy I'm feeling, and also that sort of what's the point of being on this world if you're not happy whilst you're here. And you know, I one of the books I read about this had an analogy where sort of some people's happiness thermostats are more geared to sort of Minnesota temperatures and some people are more geared to California temperatures. And despite being in California, my natural thermostat is probably more Minnesota. So spending a lot of time understanding what I can do to move the needle along that, which obviously is partly personal fulfillment, but also I think hugely important to sort of my own sort of effectiveness and professional performance.
Well, I agree. And thank you for sharing that too. I think that's an important one for a lot of people to reflect on and ensure they're on that track that they should be on. So always good to hear how others are thinking about it. I appreciate that. Well, the other thing I'm always curious, you've been successful in a number of different areas of your career. Are there consistent rituals or approaches or things that you've had that you've used to help you as you think about that consistent success?
It's a really interesting question. And one thing I'll say at the beginning is I wish I was better at sort of establishing rituals. I'm definitely, if you look at the Myers-Briggs framework, I'm definitely sort of on the side of people that do well adapting to circumstance. But I will tell you one ritual that has served me really well over the years, which is if I find I'm struggling with something or I don't know the answer or I've produced something but it feels like it's missing something, I very consciously sort of put it down, assuming that I don't need to go immediately onto something else, in which case I'll come back and do this. I spend 5 minutes thinking about really, well, what's the question I'm trying to answer here? And then I forget all about it. I get outside and I go for a hike or I go for a run or I go and do something physical. And an hour later, without having thought about it, something at some point will have popped into my head that either is the answer or is the key to the answer. And so that's one that's been super powerful for me.
That's so interesting. And I do agree with that. I think the other is that idea of letting your mind even overnight marinate on a particular issue or topic that you, I mean, it, for some, at least insomnia, but I think that sort of subconscious or physically stimulated mind is a really interesting phenomenon. So thank you for sharing that. That is super cool. Well, last question, what are you most excited about with Clarus this year?
I am just sort of super excited with continuing to work with the team we've got. I just derive so much pleasure from how the team's evolved over time. But I am also sort of super excited about helping clients make some real progress on what is the future of partner banking BaaS, where we started. That seems to me a question that is intellectually interesting. It's up for grabs, and I am convinced that sort of finding the answer is going to be a real driver of positive innovation in the US. And that's exactly the combination I look for, and I'm excited to, at least in a small way, help build a better model there.
Awesome. Well, Adam, thank you. As I knew it would be, super fun conversation. I appreciate you joining, and I appreciate all the contributions that you and your colleagues have to the industry, because to your point, it takes, in many cases, a lot of people collaborating together to drive some of these new models and new innovations forward. And having that experience and that advice to bring is so critical. So I appreciate that. And I look forward to continuing to find ways to work together.
Absolutely. Thank you. This has been great. And I mean, I think these sorts of conversations are really, I appreciate you sort of doing this. It's a helpful contribution to just helping everyone figure it out, because this is a world where rising tide lifts all boats.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Operate Podcast. If you like this conversation, as a favor to me, you can rate us, review us, or subscribe, or tell your friends. You can also reach out to us on Twitter @Operate Podcast. Until next week, get out there and operate.